The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League. Is Eddie Nketiah that kind of player? Is he more that kind of player than James Tarkowski? And at what point does a Jamie Vardy flying spinning kick become intentional? There's some actual football to talk about. Fun at Palace as Benteke scores a goal, but Chelsea win. An overhead kick from Danny Welbeck, but where does it rate on the Sinclair scale? West Ham play their way back into the relegation fight. Sheffield United's European push continues and David Silva scores a beauty. We'll talk Eric Dier's ban, Championship goals, a Juve defeat, and can Pierluigi Collina make the VAR chat stop? All that, plus what's it like to be a football scout, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you very much, Max.
What have you got planned for the day?
I've got a day watching cricket on telly, hopefully, if the rain stays off in Southampton, and a bottle of champagne for the morning and early afternoon, and then a bottle of Schweppegunder for the late afternoon and evening.
Barry Glendenning, did you understand the second drink that Wilson said there?
Of course I did. I'm not a Philistine. It's a Pinot Noir from sort of Germany, as far as I know.
As far as Wilson told you about 2 minutes before we came on air. And a debut for Jonathan Faduba, founder and editor of Just Football, host of the Nordic Football Podcast, and a football consultant, and the only person not to have downloaded Zoom in the lockdown until this morning. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Yeah, I finally succumbed. I was trying my best to avoid Zoom at all costs, but you've got me.
How have you coped, Jonathan, without inane, dreary quizzes and talking to people you don't really like and haven't seen for years?
To be honest, I've used other video webcasters, but sort of just try to stay away from Zoom as much as possible. As you can see, my hair's grown out. I've got a quarantine afro coming along and try my best to just survive it all. But yeah, no, I'm all good.
Now, Matt says, is this a pod debut for Jonathan Faduba? If so, I'd love to know what the official pod initiation for newbies is. Having to get in front of everyone and sing a passage from Inverting the Pyramid, a sustained volley from Barry's water pistol, which is not a euphemism, and eating the whole of one of Sid's hams. Can you confirm, Jonathan, that it is initiation-free, sort of banter-free zone so far?
Yeah, you've been very kind to me so far. Very kind indeed. I think of the three options, one of Sid's hams sounds quite like, decent. But
a whole ham is quite the ordeal, but like, we'll happily send one over.
A lot of salt.
You get on.
Yeah, exactly.
It's salty, isn't it?
Too much sodium.
Important to note that he'd rather eat an entire ham, kilos of pork, than just sing one paragraph from your book, Jonathan.
Well, I think that's a mark of respect. The book's not to be sung. It's to be read and digested and understood. And I appreciate that.
Okay, let's start at the Emirates. Arsenal 1, Leicester 1. And I know people get annoyed when you talk about decisions and don't talk about the football, but I'm quite looking forward to talking about decisions. It seems so long. Was that a red card? Nketiah on James Justin. I even got into what could be called the least aggressive Twitter spat with Gary Lineker, who didn't think it was a red card. I can't see how anybody doesn't think that is a red card offence. Barry?
I thought so, absolutely. I don't think he intended to hurt the opposition player, but that is irrelevant, and it was a dangerous tackle and it could have had serious consequences. I'm slightly baffled that anyone would think it isn't a red, but former professionals seem to have a skewed view on these matters and are all about, did he get the ball, was there intent, and those things don't matter in situations like this.
Jonathan?
I thought it was a red card, to be honest. Yeah, I did. It was a bit clumsy. I don't think he had real malice in it, but it was one of those challenges in the modern day where you look at it and it's badly timed, and I think it probably was a red card, to be honest.
I had a fun chat with a mate on Twitter who said, he's young and enthusiastic, it can't be a red. And I was thinking, does that mean if you're old and you don't give a shit, that it is a red? If Glenn Whelan is just sort of wandering about going, sod this, and then he piles in with his, knee height. Wilson on this?
Yeah, I thought it was a red as soon as I saw it, and nothing has led me to change my mind. I'm, and I've, yeah, like you, I'm slightly surprised by people who think it's not. It just seems to me, you know, we know what that law is now. If you go in aggressively with your studs that high and a straight leg, then it's just a red card. And thankfully, it didn't cause an injury, but it easily could have done.
Yeah, from Law 12, any player who lunges at an opponent in challenging for the ball from the front, from the side or from behind using one or both legs with excessive force or endangers the safety of an opponent is guilty of serious foul play. Now, I was quite vocal on this on Twitter on the night, Jonathan. And then James Tarkowski did a very similar thing on Jared Bowen and lots of Arsenal fans started yelling at me. Would you say that Tarkowski challenge is also a red?
I'm going to say yes, just to avoid Arsenal fans kind of doing the same to me, I think it was as well.
I mean, I can now see like Arsenal fans' frustration at that inconsistency, and I suppose, you know, broadening it out for everyone, Baz, that those two things seem very similar, and yet one, he goes to the monitor, we all want to see refs going to the monitor, and then this time they just sort of had a look and went, nah, crack on.
I think Tarkowski should have got a red as well. There's always been inconsistency. It can be a bit annoying. I personally don't think it's that much of a big deal. The thing is that VAR was brought in to get rid of these inconsistencies, and it clearly hasn't, which sort of leads to the obvious question, why bother with it in the first place? I think they shouldn't have bothered with it. Nothing has happened to change my mind, but it hasn't changed anything particularly. It's resulted in a load of really pedantic, nitpicky decisions about offsides and whatnot that I don't think are of any benefit to anyone, really.
And now in the Times today, Martin Ziegler writing that Kolina has taken control of VAR from David Ellery in a sort of referee's war, which sounds quite entertaining, really. Do you know if that means anything, Barry? Or is it just another man, another old ex-ref who we probably prefer?
Well, rather than having two bald men fighting over a comb, we're having two bald men fighting over who gets to be in charge of VAR. What it means, essentially, is that the Premier League will no longer be able to decide which bits of VAR to cherry-pick and apply to their game and which bits to ignore. I expect it could have an effect on the reluctance of the Premier League to have referees consult their pitch-side monitor, I think if VAR is here to stay, which unfortunately it is, that can only be a good thing, that they'll have a universality all over the world and a consistency all around the world of how VAR is used. Because the Premier League seem to think they're better than every other league, so, you know, we'd use this bit of VAR, but we won't use that bit. And it's a thing that's always kind of annoyed me and puzzled me.
Now, just before we move on to actual football, a lot of people, I say people, I mean Arsenal fans, were saying, well, what about Jamie Vardy's spinning double kick on the head of Mustafi? Why is that not a red card? Wilson, why is that not a red card?
Maybe it should have been. I don't know about that. I think Nketiah was a definite red. That one, I guess it just depends whether the referee thinks it was deliberate or not, in that it's not one of those wild challenges. It's sort of a leg spinning round. I don't understand why the ref wouldn't check the monitor for that. I think it's one of those that the more often you see it and the slower you see it, the worse it looks. As to whether it was an accidental collision or whether it was deliberate, I've got absolutely no idea. And I guess in those circumstances, maybe the ref's first instinct is the one you should trust, because he's the one who's seen it in context and in real time.
Well, the point being, intent doesn't matter with the Nketiah challenge, right?
Because yeah, exactly.
The type of challenge, and intent does matter. Although, Jonathan, I mean, I don't know how you feel about Jamie Vardy, if you think he has that in his locker. But you know when he just turns, his eyes just turn. And there's a little part of me that thinks he knows exactly what he's doing.
I think that's one of those ones where kind of technology and video can incriminate anybody, if that makes sense. There's a lot of incidents where when you slow it down to split seconds and replay it and replay it on slow motion, it can look worse than it is. And you could argue that maybe Jamie Vardy does have that in him, maybe. But I didn't personally think it was a red at the time, to be honest. And as Jonathan Wilson says, I think the referee's instinct probably was okay in that case.
I think in that situation, you have to give Vardy the benefit of the doubt. I'm not convinced he deserves it, but I think you have to give it to him. And even if the ref had consulted the pitch side monitor, it's very hard to prove intent there, even if the more I look at it, the more I think there was intent there.
Yeah, I thought it was totally accidental, but the more I see it, the more I see it, the more I think, oh, I'm not so sure. Now, Jonathan, you watch a lot of academy football and youth football, and you've discovered lots of footballers. Did you discover Saka? Is he one of yours? Did you know he was going to be good when he was, you know, 4 years old?
I can't claim to have discovered Saka, no. I mean, I can't claim to have discovered anyone really when they were 4 years old. But no, Saka's been, I think, known within Arsenal, you know, within the quarters of Arsenal and the academy for a long time. I saw him in FA Youth Cup games and that kind of thing, and he stood out, played in a more kind of advanced role. So when he came through and was playing at left back, I think it was maybe just to maybe do a job. But what was really encouraging was how well he adapted to that role. There were some teams who maybe tried to exploit him because of his height. And that was only one weakness in terms of him as a left back, maybe long term. But every other side of it, he really dealt with quite well in the Europa League games and that kind of thing. Obviously, he's really positionally versatile and now started to play in a more forward role. I think there's a lot of excitement about Saka, obviously, at Arsenal and the fans. You know, he signed the thing, as their Twitter account said. And he's got, you know, obviously the new deal, Arsenal fans are delighted about it. I think he is a real talent, and I think the hype is probably justified at this point in terms of how well he's doing.
Wilson, I was really quite impressed with Arsenal in spells here. And actually, since their calamitous start to restart, they've started to look quite good. I fear for what they might do to Spurs on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, they'd won four in a row before the Leicester game. And in that first half, I think it's probably as well as I've seen them play since, I don't know, not even late Wenger, but mid to late Wenger. And, you know, the red card obviously did change that. And I think the game had started to slip away from a little bit even before that. But yeah, I it's an odd thing when you're looking at them and Tottenham going into Sunday's game, that for the first time in 4 or 5 years, you'd say Arsenal are in the better position. And that's despite all the stuff with Keir Jabshin and all the weirdness with contracts and all the obvious problems they still have. You're there, the team who now, of the two of them, who seem to have a plan, and the team who have the fleet of very exciting young players, of whom Saka is probably the best. But, you know, Willock as well, and Reece Nelson, and yeah, there's a load of them.
Barry, what do you make of Leicester?
Well, I think they were very lucky to get a point from that game, because Arsenal should have been out of sight by half time. I would have liked if James Maddison had been fit to give Arsenal more of a test. He didn't play, and Leicester were missing their fullbacks as well, their first choice fullbacks. So I don't think we saw Leicester at their best, but it was a very impressive display by Arsenal, albeit one they left behind them because they should have won.
They've got, you know, 4 points on Man United in fifth and 7 points. Is that seven? 59 minus 52.
Seven points.
They've got a 7-point advantage over Wolves. Man United have got a game in hand. Obviously, we get that CAS verdict on Monday, we think, about Manchester City. Do you think Leicester have got enough to stay in that top four, Jonathan?
I think there's worrying signs for Leicester, to be honest, and they are kind of tanking. They've only won 3 games since the beginning of January in the league. So, you know, it's been a sort of quite a strange season, hasn't it, in the sense that all the bigger teams who were floundering at the beginning of the season, and Leicester kind of ran away and looked like they were, you know, well clear and definitely getting Champions League. And then all of a sudden, they've just sort of slowed down, and they've lost so many games and or drawn so many games where it's almost weird that they haven't been caught up yet, if that makes sense. But yeah, I think they're struggling, and with four or five games to go, I'm not convinced they're going to definitely wrap up that third spot.
I mean, to use an analogy that everyone will understand, Scottish female middle distance runners of the 90s, it's sort of a Liz McColgan, Yvonne Murray attempt by just getting out in the lead as quickly as you can, and then basically almost dying as the laps finish, but still being there or thereabouts and getting a bronze medal at the end. That's
a terrible analogy.
Why?
Because they were never out in front.
Were they not? McColgan always went early, didn't she?
No, Leicester weren't.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
Well, they were out in front of the teams challenging for bronze.
Exactly. Imagine a middle distance race where there was somebody so good right? And I can't think of one of them off the top of my head that they made a great run for second place and then they faded. Is that better, Barry?
Nuruddin Morcelli. Was he an opera singer? No, that's Botticelli.
That's Botticelli. There's never been a race where Botticelli took on...
No, he was an artist, wasn't he? Oh,
Botticelli...
You and your analogies, Venus.
Although, if Botticelli had taken on Yvonne Murray and Liz McColgan, that would be an, you know, an athletics meet I would like to see.
Wait, which year is this happening in?
It's going to happen in, I'm going to go, 1672.
Well, they could have some sort of, you know... a biathlon where you have to run 5,000 meters and then paint a fresco on the ceiling of a chapel.
Were any of them alive in 1672?
No, Botticelli was at least 150 years dead.
Anyway, it's something to pitch to Quest or Dave, see if they can come up with it.
I'm sorry, maybe you could take DNA material and in the style of Jurassic Park, you could create them.
Okay, well, I'm not. Well, look, while you're watching the cricket this afternoon, it's just something to do on the side, Wilson, okay?
Well, DNA experiments with Yvonne Murray.
Yeah, I think so. Crystal Palace 2, Chelsea 3. Much as I'd like to carry on this analogy, which when I began the analogy, I thought this probably won't make it into the pod, but I feel it might make it now. I thought this was one of the best games of restart, Jonathan, and I thought... By the end, Palace were really quite unlucky not to have got something from the game.
Yeah, I think they were, and I think you're right. It was one of the better games for sure. Obviously, Zaha with a great strike, and I think the first time that Benteke and Danny Welbeck have been on the score sheet since the PlayStation 4 came out or something like that. It was a crazy stat.
Duncan Alexander, wasn't it?
Yeah, a bit of a throwback in terms of some of the goal scorers. Yeah, Chelsea looking good. They're top of the form guide, I think, in the Premier League. I think they've won 5 of their last 6 games. Under Lampard, sort of things are coming together. Christian Pulisic is starting to come into form. He's a really good player, and I think he's just starting to find his feet now after injury. It seems to be sticking with Giroud, who was on the score sheet, but they've got a lot of options. Tammy Abraham as well, who's back on the score sheet. So, yeah, things are looking quite good for Chelsea at the moment.
Wilson, you've obviously been consistent in your support for Frank Lampard and belief that it would all come good for Chelsea by the end of the season. And all those things you said about him seem to be coming true.
Well, they can't defend. They're almost certainly going to get a lower points total. I think they have to win every game from now on to get a higher points total than they got last season. Look, my criticism of Lampard has always been they can't defend set pieces and they can't defend counter-attacks. And they haven't got any... I don't see they've got any better at either of those as the season's gone on. So those are my doubts, those are my concerns. I think the transfer policy at the moment seems very heavily weighted at the front of the team. And yeah, Lampard's comment after the West Ham game that they needed bigger players at the back, I think suggests he is looking to bring in defenders, which are needed. I guess my problem is I just think people aren't, for some reason, they're focusing completely on the positives of Chelsea, whereas with Sarri it was the opposite. And Sarri almost certainly will end up having got more points in his first season there than Lampard did. And this sort of idea that, oh, well, you know, Lampard's learning the game, he's still a young manager. That's true, but it's Chelsea. Why is he learning at Chelsea? Yeah, they're one of the biggest 6 clubs in England. Yeah, they should have somebody who can actually do the job, not somebody who's learning it as he's going.
Yash says, in chasing Kai Havertz, Chelsea look to be adding more attacking flair to a squad already overloaded in that department. Does this point to Kepa Arrizabalaga still making key decisions at Chelsea, trying to steer the narrative away from his inconsistent performances? I mean, you mentioned, Jonathan, that great strike from Zaha, but Baz, I sort of wondered if a better keeper would have saved it.
Possibly. I think Kepa's a decent keeper. I don't think he's bad. I wouldn't imagine getting a new keeper in is a priority at Chelsea. He's possibly not as good as people thought he was going to be, but he's all right as far as I can tell. But I think I know when keepers have made a mistake or not, and then I look at David Priest on Twitter pointing out that I'm completely wrong, or, you know, the general consensus is completely wrong. But, yeah, he strikes me as being okay.
Well, I think the point with him as well is that if Chelsea were to sell him, they won't get anything like the, what do they pay for him, 70, just over 70 million, mm-hmm. was it? Mm-hmm. They'll get nothing like that for him in this market. So I think from that point of view, there'll be a reluctance to sell until the market settles down and people work out, you know, what was happened to prices.
I mean, I guess, you know, you mentioned David Priest, who quite often says pundits say things about goalkeepers that just patently aren't true. And I guess occasionally we should accept that footballers kick a ball really quite hard, and that's quite hard to save.
Well, I think that Zaha goal, it sort of moved late as well, didn't it? It sort of just swerved at the, you know, late in its path. So yeah, I don't think it was impossible to save, but I don't think it's a mistake not to save it.
Matt Woosnam from The Athletic says Crystal Palace have the worst record from attacking corners. One goal. He watched all 165 corners, so we didn't have to. 14 of them were short corners. 14 of them didn't beat the first man. 77 didn't reach a Palace player, and mostly went into the 6-yard box or back of the area for Gary Cahill. But hopefully they will make a DVD of 165 Crystal Palace corners and one goal. Let's move on to the Amex Brighton 1 Liverpool 3. But Barry, I don't think I've seen Brighton play that well all season. I mean, I know that sounds ridiculous, and they did gift Liverpool a 2-goal start, but I thought they played really good football.
Yeah, they could conceivably have got a draw from this game, even having gifted Liverpool those 2 early goals with poor mistakes as they tried to play out from the back. And if they hadn't conceded those, and this is a bit, if your auntie had balls, she'd be your uncle, but I thought they possibly deserved a point anyway. They missed some decent chances. You know, it's hard to gauge Liverpool right now. I don't think they're playing anywhere near top gear because they've won the championship and they're not that fussed. And even though they make these claims about wanting to get record tally of points or whatever, I wouldn't imagine they're that fussed about it.
Jonathan, how long have you been banging the Tariq Lamptey drum?
He's a very good player. Yeah, really highly rated. I think Brighton have done extremely well to get him from Chelsea. I was quite surprised Chelsea let him go, if I'm honest, but I know they've got a lot of options, maybe, you know, Reece James. He's a very big talent. Brighton in general have a fantastic scouting department. They've got a lot of young talents coming through. Alexis McAllister as well, who they've signed. Aaron Connolly, I think he's a good prospect as well. Only 20, he's showing glimpses, which will excite Irish fans. They've got a lot of players in their academy that are coming through. So Lamptey's a really, really good attacking player, and I think he's only going to go on and prove himself.
Is he Mac Allister, or is that just, there's just a gap on his name on the back of the shirt?
No, it's deliberate. It's Mac Allister. In Irish, it's Mac is a derivation of the word mock, which is son. So that would mean he's the son of Alistair. I think he's Argentinian, isn't he?
He is.
Yeah. So it's a similar thing. He's the son of, I would imagine his father's name is Alistair. That's and Mock Alistair is son of Alistair.
Oh, so that's the Irish for Inyo.
Yeah, pretty much.
I was just checking whether McAllister was indeed the son of Esteban McAllister, and he is.
Just for those, obviously we all know, but just for those who don't know, who is that?
He played for Argentina in the early 90s. I'm going to say, although I haven't really thought this through, the last ginger-haired man to play for Argentina. And the family's from Fife originally, but yeah, they went over to Argentina. There's a lot, I don't know if he was part of this, but there was a lot of Scottish families went over in the 1840s. He was the son of a man who was a clerk at the Bank of Scotland, who went over to South America and set up a trading company and made an absolute fortune and lost a load of money in the 1820s. And his way of trying to regain it was to set up one of these sort of utopian farming communities just south of Buenos Aires. And so loads of Scottish families, it was literally 6 or 7 ships of Scottish smallholders went over to join this farm of his farming community. And it collapsed, you know, as these things do, but loads of them stayed. And so there was one of them called James Brown, who had a son called James Brown, and 7 of his sons played for Argentina, and they all played for alumni who dominated Argentinian football between sort of 1900 and 1911.
on that note, can you think of a more lopsided fullback duo than 6'7" Dan Byrne and 5'3" Tarik Lamptey?
No, surely. I mean, Alan Wright wouldn't have played with anybody. I mean, if Alan Wright and Peter Crouch had ever played our fullback together, but I don't think that ever did happen. But maybe we should make it happen in a charity game.
Okay. There's so many things to do after this. there was one moment of Virgil van Dijk, Barry, where he cushioned a header. You know, it's this really long ball. I think every other centre-back would have just headed out of play. He sort of cushioned it over Connolly's head and then just breezed past him and collected the ball. And it was just this sort of poetic bit of defending that you never see.
Yeah, I assumed he'd sort of head it back to the keeper rather than out of play. But it's just the sign of a man with nothing to worry about, who's absolutely at the top of his game and full of confidence. It annoys me a bit, these games behind closed doors where little bits of individual brilliance like that don't get the applause they deserve. You know, that would have got, you know, it would get them out of their seats at the Crucible Theatre if it was a snooker shot, or get a big round of applause. And to see it just sort of go unnoticed, well, although we are obviously talking about it now, but is quite sad, I think.
Liverpool need 9 points from 4 games to pass City's record of 100 points. They've got Burnley, Arsenal, Chelsea and Newcastle. And Adam Lallana looks likely to join Leicester on a free at the end of the season. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Vicarage Road. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. July the 21st, a live show of sorts. Not an official Guardian event, a live stream though. You can watch it from the comfort of your living room or out and about if you choose to. Wilson, you're going to be there. What are you offering the people?
Stories about Scottish farming communities in the 19th century.
So there you are, £5 if you want more on that. Barry, you'll be in the corner. Lars will bring his dog. It's open to the whole of the earth. Watford 2, Norwich 1. Danny Welbeck's overhead kick there broke his 13-game run of not being on the winning side since joining Watford last August. Huge win for Watford at the bottom. But most importantly, on the Trevor Sinclair scale, I'm giving this overhead kick a 4 out of 10. Jonathan, are you happy with that? Are you happy that it only gets a 4, or do you think Danny Welbeck deserves more?
I think Danny Welbeck deserves more, most definitely. Yeah, I think there's a Welbeck additional rate there that needs to be added, maybe just a 2, just because it's Danny
Welbeck. I'm not bringing sympathy. Are you bringing sympathy into the Sinclair scale?
I think I am. I think just because he's been out for so long, and so long since he scored a goal. I think, is it 2 years nearly since a Premier League goal, something like that? There has to be that added bonus, I believe. But in terms of technique, yeah, the Sinclair scale is a quite a tough scale to be on, I suppose. So I'd rate it about a 6.
Okay, I gave Rooney a 6 because it's a shin, and I gave Bale an 8, and Muzzy is it, which is a great overhead kick, a 9. Wilson, you're shaking your head. You're going to come up with...
No, I think you're being very generous to Rooney giving that a 6. I think you're harsh on Bale giving that an 8. I think the Bale one was magnificent.
On Bale, it's the reason Sinclair is a 10 for me is the pace of the cross. So it's, you know, that makes it technically harder for me. And it was a bit floaty, the cross to Bale. Obviously, Welbeck, the ball's just sitting in the air, and it's a bit of a slice as well. So, it doesn't come close. But you're right. I mean, I was in the stadium for that Bale goal, and there was an audible silence before everyone realised what a brilliant moment it was. I'm happy to reclassify Bale.
Yeah, it might not be quite as good as a Sinclair one, but it's surely 9, 9.5. But I think, Welbeck 4 is about right, because it's great for him. And, I really hope he gets back and playing and scoring regularly. It's a hugely important goal for Watford, but it's not a clean strike. And you almost see on Tim Krul's face the look of disgust of, I've been beaten by an overhead kick. It's not even really a good one, but I can't get there. And so, I guess he doesn't really care. It's a goal.
The best bit about the Sinclair one, because I watched it about 5 times this morning, there are 2 Barnsley fans who are absolutely outraged with the defending. And you're like, it's not like a soft goal. You know, they're stood up going, what the hell are you doing to like the Barnsley keeper in defence? You're like, you know, that is applaud the opposition moment, isn't it? Watford now 4 points clear of the relegation zone, having played a game more than Villa and Bournemouth. Norwich will be relegated on Saturday if they're beaten at home by West Ham. A Richard Jolly tweet, 67% of goals scored by Watford players since February were overhead kicks, which is a great stat. Jonathan, is that enough for Watford, do you think, given Villa and Bournemouth are sort of lolloping around doing nothing?
I think it's just about enough. I think Villa, Bournemouth and Norwich will go down. And I mean, Watford are just about doing enough. I feel a little bit for them because I think the break has disrupted their momentum. Obviously, they beat Liverpool 3-0 in the one of the last games before the pandemic. Ismaïla Sarr was in really good form as well. They looked like under Nigel Pearson, they were bringing things together quite well. And then, they've been probably one of the worst teams since the restart. But I think they will just about have enough. I think Villa concede so many goals and Bournemouth are kind of... I saw the Newcastle game and they were terrible. So I struggle to see how Villa and Bournemouth might get out of it, to be honest.
West Ham 0, Burnley 1. So West Ham not out of danger. Jay Rodriguez with the only goal. Good header as well. Nick Pope was really good in this game, Barry. And I know you have a love for Jordan Pickford because of what he did at Sunderland. But the difference in sort of calmness and diving when you need to dive and saving it between Nick Pope and Jordan Pickford seems quite extreme.
I do hold Jordan Pickford in extremely high regard just because he sort of carved out his reputation playing in a terrible team when he was letting in lots of goals and he was only a child, basically, which is very hard to do. So he deserves immense kudos for that. But I don't think he should be within an ass's roar of the England team at the moment. If I was a defender, I'm not sure I'd fancy playing in front of him. He's very excitable. He's very... But sort of touch of the Joe Hart. Maybe even worse in how excited he gets. Maybe that works for him. But I don't think he should be in the England team on merit anymore.
Look, if you're looking at sort of absolute form, I completely accept that point. My one question... And the reason I think Southgate perseveres with Pickford, other than sort of a basic loyalty to somebody who's always done well for him, is Southgate wants to play a relatively high line. He wants to pass out from the back. Pope just doesn't do that week in, week out. I'm not saying he can't do it. I'm just saying he's not getting regular practice doing that. Pickford has proved he can do it and is excellent with his feet. And I think there's a very good chance that at some point England will score a key goal from Pickford smacking a 70-yard pass exactly into the path of one of the array of incredibly quick forwards they've suddenly got. So I think it's not quite as simple as pure form, but Pickford's form is clearly a concern. And one of the ways where England may benefit from the delay of the Euros is they've got another year to work that out.
Burnley up to ninth, above Spurs, above Everton. And, with all the problems that Sean Dyche has had in terms of, recruitment or from what we hear, like support from... above him, and we do give him quite a lot of credit, I think, Barry, but should we be giving him more credit?
I think he gets the credit he deserves from us, certainly, and elsewhere. Everyone always talks about him in glowing terms. He's been eclipsed this season by Chris Wilder. They're both kind of similar characters. I would imagine if a big job came up, say, I don't know, Tottenham, for example, I don't think Dyche would get it, would even be considered for it. I think Wilder would.
I don't know if it's a cliche, the style of football that Burnley play.
Yeah, that's not a cliche, that's a fact. Burnley play a particular style of football, which I think Arsenal, Tottenham fans, players, board would see as not suitable for them. Chris Wilder's football, with the overlapping centre-backs, he's doing something interesting tactically, whereas Dyche is doing something relatively familiar tactically, but doing it very, very well. So I think we shouldn't be afraid to sort of say that there are different qualities needed at different levels of club. And I'm not saying Dyche couldn't do a Tottenham, for instance, but the evidence that he can do it is not necessarily there. So I think he'd have to interview incredibly well and sort of set out his vision for Tottenham in a way that persuaded the board and then could persuade fans who I think would instinctively sort of be, I'm not really sure that's for us, that his vision was was more than lumping it long to Chris
Wood. Sure, but, you know, at least, you know, under Jose, they knock it long to someone short like Lucas Moura. At least if they had Sean Dyche, they'd knock it long to someone tall.
Yeah, yeah, there is that. And this is I mean, this is sort of what my column's going to be about this weekend. You know, Joso's special one press conference is closer to Gazza's tears than it is to today.
I don't want to feel older than I feel.
Yeah, but it's not just about us feeling old, although that did make me feel very old. It's a danger that people have, I mean, I was going to say our age, but I'm conscious that I'm older than you, mine and Barry's age, that things that were happening early in our journalistic lives are just not relevant to modern football, or they're relevant in a historical sense. So, you know, the Jose at his peak, when he was a Porto, when he was his first two seasons at Chelsea, maybe going through to Inter in 2010, that is as relevant to modern football as
Liz McColgan is to Botticelli?
For instance, or Sacchi's football was to Mourinho, in that it's a thing that happened in the past, it's informed how football is played, but it doesn't have a lot of relevance in the modern game. And I think we're sort of stuck with this sort of the image of Jose without really sort of looking at the reality of it.
Can I just make a counterpoint? I mean, just in terms of Sean Dyche, I just wonder if you guys think that one of the aspects of managers that I always wonder is the top managers kind of get to a Spurs or an Arsenal and they have the chance to build a team with a lot bigger budget and have the actual chance to build a more attacking kind of squad. Obviously, you know, Sean Dyche, I sometimes wonder when this debate comes up, like would say a Mourinho or a, you know, another manager like that be able to get Burnley to kind of seventh in the Premier League, which they did in you know, 2018 type thing. I know that he's had issues, but sometimes I think, is that because of the club he's at? And are we not giving him maybe enough credit for the job he's done at a club where, you know, Burnley have been in the Premier League for at least 4 or 5 years now. He's kept them up. He's kept them kind of in a decent league position. They're ninth at the moment in the Premier League. With not a great squad, really, when you look at it. They just turned to, you know, become a Category 1 academy, which is, you know, he's kind of like rebuilt the whole club to a certain extent. I wonder, do we not think that a manager like that would have the intelligence to go to another club, say a bigger club, and find better attacking players, that kind of thing?
No, I think that's fair. And I think that's a problem that a lot of British managers have when they get a small team promoted and then they kind of stuck playing a particular form of football, and you never quite see what they can do. And that's why I say that it's not he necessarily can't do it, it's that there's limited evidence he could do it, and that's why his interview would have to be incredibly good to sort of set what his vision would be. But yeah, I think that point is a real problem for British managers who do well with smaller clubs. That I mean, I think you saw it with Eddie Boothroyd at Watford. That Eddie Boothroyd came up, you know, with a squad that was kind of pretty much hopeless. You know, it was a miracle that Watford team got promoted. And then Eddie Boothroyd kept being criticised for playing long ball football. And I went to a few games that season where he'd be sat in the post-match press conference going, look at my players. How do you think I can play with this lot? You know, we're playing to their strengths. So yeah, that is definitely an issue.
A couple of West Ham fans getting in touch to ask, could there be anything more West Ham than David Moyes considering a double swoop for Phil Jones and Jesse Lingard? You can just see them in a West Ham shirt.
Yeah, I mean, going for Manchester United cast-offs, that worked so well at Sunderland. You know, Darren Gibson, he had a brilliant Sunderland career until the drinking and the driving offences. Adnan Januzaj, he did really well there. Donald Love's gone on in leaps and bounds. Paddy McNair, fully deserved that move to Middlesbrough. I mean, four magnificent signings. So yeah, if it ain't broke, why would you try to fix it?
Manchester City 5, Newcastle 0. Barry, you did the minute by minute for this game. Tell us all the interesting things that happened.
Well, Manchester City were excellent. David Silva was absolutely outstanding. Before the game, Steve Bruce said they needed to be more positive in their approach because they were very negative in their cup game 11 days ago. And got a hiding, and they were even more negative in this game and got a hiding. I think the 5-0 scoreline flattered Newcastle. To be fair to them, they were missing several key players, including their two best players in Miguel Almiron and Alan Saint-Maximin. Jamel Lascelles was out. They were missing a lot of players through injury, but they had an air about them of a team that knew they were going to lose before they even went out on the pitch, and lose they duly did. And I think they could consider themselves very lucky to have only lost by 5. It was always on the cards because they were missing so many players. But it was a very meek approach they had to the game. And, you know, they even when they had possession themselves, there was one stage they got a free kick just inside their own half. And within a couple of seconds, the ball was back with their own keeper, who then proceeded to boot it towards the halfway line. You're just going, well, what is the point of this? But it's hard to be critical of them when they were so depleted personnel-wise, and they were playing at City, who had just lost their previous game.
Jonathan, David Silva sent a tweet going, I'm going to miss this team with a blue heart. He's got a lovely free kick. Do you want to show him any love?
Yeah, I mean, I think he'll go down as... I don't think it's exaggerating it to say one of City's best ever players, to be honest. That's probably the highest praise I can give him. I think he's an incredible player. You can think back to even games. I remember when they beat Manchester United 6-1. He was really, really good in that game, for example. You know, he's been doing it for so many years, David Silva, just sort of year after year. You know, other players have come along and done quite well at City, but he's always just been there ticking along. I think he's had a real influence on Phil Foden as well. You can, when you watch Foden, you can kind of see elements of David Silva's game in there that he's probably, you know, been mentoring him maybe. One of the best players in Premier League history, in my opinion. But a weird thing about City, just City have scored 18 goals in their last 6 games and conceded just 3 goals. So they've scored the most goals of any team in the last 6 games and conceded the fewest, and yet they've lost 2 games. And I think that kind of just sums up their season, really. Like, you concede 3 goals and score 18, but you still manage to lose two games. On their day, they are, I think, still the most exciting team in the Premier League in terms of just ripping teams to pieces. But they just seem to have these odd moments where they lose by a goal or can't seem to score, isn't it? And that's summed up their season, really.
Tommy Doyle came on in this game for City to make his Premier League debut. And both his grandfathers played for City as well, with, I think, they've over 900 appearances between them for Manchester City. I was just wondering, Jonathan, do you know much about young Tommy?
To be honest, I can't say I know a huge amount about him, to be fair. I mean, City have been in a strange situation where during the lockdown, some of their better academy players didn't train with the first team because they were abroad. So you had players like, for example, Jaden Braff, who was really, really highly rated, and others who, you know, he's Dutch, for example. And they took the decision, I believe, to not bring them into the first team training. So they went for more kind of UK-based players from their academy to come through. So I wouldn't necessarily say their best academy players maybe are getting chances at the moment. Braff's a good example. He's kind of an incredible talent, but is going down the maybe Sancho path, where there's starting to be a little bit of tension between him and the club, not maybe getting first team opportunities that he feels he deserves. And he is that kind of Sancho type player. So yeah, I think City have kind of looked more to the domestic academy players post-restart to kind of fill out the squad.
Number one when Tommy Doyle was born was Can't Get You Out of My Head by Kylie. If he'd been born 3 days later, it would have been Afro Man, Because I Got High. Wow.
I think I've modelled my hair on Afro Man.
So what Jonathan was saying about Pep, do you see that actually this huge number of defeats in relative terms, it's a bit random, and actually it won't be difficult to iron those out next season?
I don't think it is easy, no, because I think what we've... It's been extreme this season. I think maybe they have been slightly unfortunate. But this habit of dominating games and losing or suddenly conceding goals on the break has been an increasing feature of Guardiola's sides. And that's why you kind of quite often see they'll apparently have a very good defensive record, but then they look terrible defensively as soon as they get against a team who can beat their press. And I think where Liverpool have really beaten them this season is that Liverpool have defensively been much improved and much better. So City have scored more goals than Liverpool this season. Liverpool have conceded significantly fewer than City. So losing Kompany and not replacing him, I think, was a big issue. I think the struggles of Otamendi and Stones are a big issue. So that's at least 2 central defenders they've got to bring in. I think Vasilis at left back, that Mendy hasn't quite kicked on after the injury. Is Zinchenko good enough? I don't know. So they might be looking at left back. And then, you know, there's all these rumours or reports that Aguero might be going to Inter in the swap deal for Skriniar, who would be a centre-back. But then if you don't have Aguero, do you score sufficient goals? And Gabriel Jesus, I can't quite work out. He's clearly a very, very good player, but I'm not sure if he's just one notch below what City need or whether he will suddenly explode and score 40 goals next season. But I think they would probably need a centre forward as well.
It's worth pointing out that we got accused of being biased against Manchester City because we didn't really talk about their win over Liverpool because it was on a Thursday and then a lot of football had happened before the Monday, but a point taken. We also were accused of being biased against Manchester United, so that was good for balance. Sheffield United 1-0. This was a pretty boring game, I thought, Barry, but you know, John Egan got another goal, and I don't know if anyone has put it to some more commentary of his dad, but you know, it was a great header, wasn't it?
Yeah, good header from a corner. An Irish goal machine is always welcome. There was an incident in this game, actually, which annoyed me a bit. The Wolves were attacking on the break. I think it was in the first half. They had a 2-on-2 sweeping forward, and Jack O'Connell of Sheffield United cynically brought down Diogo Jota on the edge of the area, and Ruben Neves hit the bar from the subsequent free kick. I think that should be a red card. I'm not being anti-Sheffield United or anything, but just cynically bringing him down on the edge of the area when it's a 2-on-2 and it really looked as if Wolves were going to score. It was a clear take a yellow for the team. I think that should be a red.
What about a sin bin? What about a 10-minute sin bin for that sort of thing?
No, I just think a straight red card.
I agree, actually. I think if you cynically, deliberately foul somebody, just a red card. But no need to do it. So,
all right. I'm happy to I'll get in touch with Kalina, see if something else to do for later.
I'm much more bothered by a deliberate foul than a tackle that's mistimed by, you know, a fraction of a second. Like, in terms of kind of destroying the flow of the game.
Before we end part two, Spurs playing Bournemouth tonight, and Eric Dyer's got a 4-game ban for entering the stands after that FA Cup defeat to Norwich when he was trying to protect his brother. Jose's been very critical of the FA about this. Dyer got a character reference from Gareth Southgate. The fan who had been having a go at his brother got in touch with Spurs and arranged a meeting that with Eric Dyer and apologised and said, like, I was being a twat. Jonathan, what do you make of a 4-game ban? Do you think it's the right thing, or he should have got no ban at all, or it wasn't draconian enough?
I think it was one of those ones where the commission probably shrugged their shoulders during the meeting and said, listen, you know, we understand where you're coming from, but we kind of have to ban you. I think the principles behind it, maybe you can say, yeah, he was getting ridiculous abuse and, you know, should players put up with that, you know, especially when their family's getting abused, that kind of thing. But at the same time, I don't think that's really, you can't really use that as an excuse to kind of then say there'll be no punishment, because it would set quite a dangerous precedent. So I think it was perhaps one of those where they concluded that, all right, you know, you're on the naughty step, here's a, you know, a smack bottom type thing. But we understand you, but we're gonna have to punish you, if that makes sense.
Barry, who would you get to write a character reference for you? Eric Dyer went straight to Southgate.
Well, I believe Southgate was unsolicited, so he didn't go to Southgate.
Oh really? Yeah. It just, oh right. So would you just hope that Southgate would write one for you?
Yeah, why not?
Oh well, fingers crossed, eh? If you ever,
I'm not sure Gareth Southgate could vouch for my good character, A, because my character isn't necessarily good, or as good as I would like it to be, and B, because I've never met Gareth Southgate and we don't know each other. Would you vouch for my good character, Max?
Well, it depends what you've done. You've steamed into the crowd at a live show.
At a live show, I've heard someone abusing my mother, and I've climbed over several rows of chairs to tell them to stop. But I haven't assaulted them in any way. One of the stewards or the security staff has got between me and them long before, and the person who was abusing my mum has run away. Like a big chicken,
right? Okay,
because they saw me coming. Would and so I'm up in, I'm in a work tribunal and I'm facing the sack. Would you vouch for my good character?
I mean, I'm really surprised that you've managed to climb across that many seats without doing yourself some sort of serious injury.
Well, the fact that you even have to think about whether or not you'd provide a character reference tells me all I need to know.
Get Barney to do it, so it's all just badger metaphor.
Yeah. Right, that'll do for part two. We'll begin part three talking to Jonathan about being a football consultant. Hello, Football Weekly fans. Max here. I'm here to tell you about a new weekly podcast series from The Guardian called Forgotten Stories of Football. Some of the best stories from over 100 years of football history that you have probably never heard, written by some of the world's leading sports journalists, many of whom you will know. Episodes still to come include the France football captain who murdered for Hitler, Dundee United's glory years under Jim McLean, and how the white ball was originally dismissed as an unwanted fad. Listen now to Forgotten Stories of Football from The Guardian on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, Jonathan F., you are a football consultant.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, the best way to describe it without probably boring you to tears is, you know, work in different areas of football. It could be player development, for example. That could be something like branding, communications, marketing of a player, for example. As you say, modelling, scouting in terms of modelling, helping clubs to gain an edge through modelling and identifying markets for players, for player development. I'd say really the main focus behind it is, yeah, developing players, maybe looking for clubs who want to look at different markets within football. So a bit of background, like I used to live in Sweden and I kind of moved out there to work with clubs out there who wanted to maybe look at the English market. Younger players and that kind of thing, or players maybe at a lower level who wanted to maybe move abroad. So I suppose a long story short to bring this to a conclusion is kind of helping player development, sourcing different markets for players to maybe move to, and at the same time, working for clubs or teams and that kind of thing.
So, I mean, can I ask what does an average day for you entail, or is there any such thing as an average day, and how much time do you spend on the sideline of football pitches compared to, say, sitting at a desk staring at a laptop?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it's changing. You probably all know as well, like, you know, player identification has moved very much from, well, especially during this pandemic, but completely 100% behind a desk. But before that, obviously, there's a lot more movement from in-stadium scouting to kind of maybe more, you think, you know, tools like Wyscout or those kind of platforms where you're, you know, watching games recorded, that kind of thing, or watching games back and look at analytics, that kind of thing. For me personally, I would say during the season when there wasn't, you know, a global pandemic, I'd be at games quite a lot. So I personally like, you know, I think there's room for the traditional and the kind of more modern types of scouting. I don't think you can really replace going to games and seeing what you see and that whole part of it, and it's something I love. So I would say in the last sort of you know, since I've been doing it, I spend a lot of time going to games live, but then yeah, during the week maybe you'd be watching a lot of games as well, recorded, that kind of thing. So you could find yourself watching second division of Sweden games like all day, kind of thing, which would probably bore a lot of people. Something I quite enjoy, so it doesn't bother me. But yeah, you do get a lot of kind of a mixture of the two, but a lot of desk work as well, that kind of thing.
And does your role, where does it stop? Like, if you find a player and you tell a club, like, how far down that journey do you go? Or do you sort of, you know, they've got an agent and then that sort of, it's kind of gone for you. Where does your role begin and end?
It can vary. So at the lower level, like you say, I can identify a player and I can recommend them to clubs or that kind of thing, or I can help the player themselves get into it and you get more of a reputation, and the higher you, the better you do, I suppose. People might then take your opinion a bit more seriously. When I began, probably nobody would care what I say, and maybe to even today probably a lot of people would say, yeah, you know, maybe your opinion isn't that valued. But I think the longer you do it and the more you know about players, the more you know about clubs, that kind of thing, that the more you can kind of say, well, this might suit this, you know, this player might suit this club, or this player might suit, you know, there's a lot of, for example, in England there's a lot of players who get released from academies who are incredible technically, but a manager will take one look at them and say, well, sorry, you're too small. immediately. That's, you know, there's so many players who have come through. David Brooks is a good example of that at Bournemouth, I think. And there's so many in England who have been identified and just said that you're too small to make it type thing. I think Jamie Vardy was similar at one point when he had to go into non-league. And so then maybe sometimes you might be looking abroad and saying, well, maybe you'd be better off in Sweden. Maybe you'd be better off in Norway. Maybe you'd be better off in a different league that's more suited to your game, more suited to your technique. So
are you sending Scott McTominay a message saying, say something like, great win for the lads, can't wait for the next one?
Yeah, it can be telling people, like, I recommend you delete that tweet saying, I can't wait to leave this crap club, I hate the manager, or something like that. You know, that's happened in the past. You know, at lower levels, like I say, non-league is probably more of my specialty in that sense. You know, there's a lot of players who've gone non-league to pro, and that's an area that I look at a lot.
Yeah, you wrote a piece about, you know, you identified seven, didn't you, a couple of years ago, and six of them are now in the league. Could you give us a name now? Are you allowed to, like, one person that in a year's time we can talk to and say, you said they would make it and they're still at Grantham?
In non-league, probably I would have said a week ago Festus Arthur, but he's now obviously moved. He's moved from Stockport to Hull. At the moment, if I was sticking my neck on the block, I would say Sorba Thomas at Boreham Wood. I think is a player who will 100% play in the league.
All right. It's fascinating, and we'll talk about it again, definitely. A couple of little things. Nicky was saying on Tuesday about what a good job Stefano Pioli's doing at Milan while the club prepared to give his job to Ralf Rangnick. On Tuesday, they were goalless at half-time, home to Juve. Juve 2-0 up after 53 minutes. Milan won 4-2. Worth finding Adrian Rabiot's opener for Juve. One of those sort of traipsing long runs upfield where nobody tries to tackle him, but still a great finish. And I don't know about you, Barry, I had completely forgotten that Zlatan was playing for AC Milan, but he scored a penalty for them. So he's
I was aware of that. I had forgotten Danny Welbeck played for Watford until not this game, but the one before.
Juve still 7 points clear. Atalanta up to third, by the way. 6 wins in a row for them. And you remember on Tuesday, Sid talking about whether Barcelona would relegate Espanyol. They did with a 1-0 win. They're a point behind Real Madrid, have played a game more. Did anyone see Piqué cycling into the Nou Camp? No helmet. And he was going really fast into a dark tunnel. I thought that was quite risky. You couldn't really see what was in there. James said, I would have preferred to see Piqué, Messi and Busquets in the stadium car park in front of the car heater trying to warm up on a cold day to make it look really Sunday league. Obviously, there was a full round of games in the Championship. You will know the results if you support those teams. But Pep Clotet has left Birmingham. They lost to Swansea. It's looking like Cardiff or Swansea for the last playoff place. So I got Ellis James to give us his thoughts. He says, the playoffs are a girl I fancy, and she hasn't got off with that bloke I resent from another school, brackets Cardiff City, quite yet. Cardiff lost 3-2 at home to Blackburn. Adam Armstrong scored what's now known as the Che Adams. It was a lovely goal. And it's worth mentioning the MLS competition, MLS's back tournament. Graham Ruthven wrote a really fascinating piece in The Guardian about what a farce it is. It's in Florida. At the ESPN Wide World of Sports complex at Disney World, FC Dallas checked in, had 6 positive tests, did 3 more and a coach, so they withdrew from the tournament. Nashville v Chicago was postponed after 5 Nashville players tested positive. Carlos Vela decided not to play. Omar Gonzalez, who plays for Toronto, tweeted out an incredibly bad packed lunch he'd been given in the bubble. It was just a really awful looking ham sandwich.
Weren't they $65 as
were
well?
They?
That's what I read, yeah. And you got like a disappointing sandwich
and a mangy banana with just sort of, you know, and a shitty carton of orange juice. And then there's an undercover MLS player. He's doing secret posts from it. His handle is at MLS COVID Cup. MLS is back insider. And one of his tweets was just it was just turning the tap on in his bathroom and the entire tap just shooting off and water spraying out to say how terrible the hotel was. But it began last night, and Orlando City beat Inter Miami, and Nani scored the winner for Orlando City, so that's where Nani is. And it was quite hilarious. Anyway, worth reading Graham Ruthven's piece. And before 2 questions about Peppers and Barry being in a pub, Jonathan, you have some quite important news.
Yeah, in Belgium, Beveren, who had been relegated, have had the relegation overturned by a court. The season wasn't completed in Belgium. So that could have implications for the French teams who've been relegated to are taking legal action against, you know, to overturn that. And then I guess potentially in Scotland as well, and maybe even in lower leagues in England. And obviously the law changes from country to country, but there is this precedent in Belgium now that a team that had been relegated in a season that wasn't finished has been unrelegated.
Of similar importance, and with reference to the Oral-B advert I was quoting on Monday and the woman with an entire shelf of peppers, Neil says, how many raw peppers do the panel, including yourself, Max, think they could eat in one go? I'd say Barry would get the most in. Jonathan Wilson.
I think quite a lot. I mean, what's the prize? Have you incentivised me?
No, this is just for honour and glory.
Oh, the greatest prize, apart from money. 30 is my initial bid.
30? Yeah. In one go?
Yeah, just to be clear, I used to work in the kitchen. One of my jobs was preparing peppers. So I'd have to prepare them myself. Okay. I'm quite fussy about this. So slicing off all the pith, all the paler flesh. Mm. I got so good I could do it by feel. Didn't even have to look.
So if you lose your sight...
Oh, yeah, I can be a pepper chopper still, yeah. No, 30. I love a pepper.
Wow. I would say 3, but they'd have to be red because a green is a much tougher prospect. Jonathan F?
I'm with you there, Max. If it's red peppers, then I'm in. If it's, you know, green, yellow, orange, and yes, just a different prospect, really.
I just thought maybe 2 or 3. I would willingly bet Wilson £100 that he cannot eat 30 peppers in one sitting.
David says, I met Barry for the second time in my life at the pub on Monday. I found myself in the surreal situation where he asked for a photo with me to send to Ellis James. I was too stunned to get one myself. If he has the photo, I'd love to see it.
Well, I do have the photo. I was in a pub beer garden, I hasten to add, not in a pub, although I did have to walk through it to get to the beer garden. The Michael was a guy I previously met at a Ellis James John Robin live show in the Comedy Store, where he did a feature that's common on their show called The Shamewell, where he told the story of him and his girlfriend visiting her parents' house years ago, and after they left, their parents found a tube of lube in the bedroom they'd been occupying and sent it back to them. So I'll be honest, I'm surprised he even shows his face in public anymore. And I wish he'd stop following me because I'm slightly scared.
Did you call him Michael?
David, sorry. I yeah.
So many fans, Barry, it's hard to keep up, isn't it? Anyway, that'll do for today. Jonathan Wilson, thank you.
Cheers, thank you.
Jonathan Faduba, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Barry Glendenning, thank you.
Thanks.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.